Kia ora and welcome to Worker's Voice. Spend the next hour with us as we discuss the tribulations and triumphs of building workers' rights and increasing fairness in the workplace. This show is produced by Unite Union.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Worker's Voice, and I'm your host, Joe Carlin, and joining me in the studio today, I have Unite Union's National Director, Michael Train.
Kia ora.
And well-known activist and comrade, Toby Muir.
Good afternoon, everyone.
And Toby, you'll be here to talk about legalizing it and, of course, your beloved New Zealand flag that you worship.
I will indeed.
All right, but first things first. Michael, it's been a good week, good month, good year for the union movement, for Unite in particular. Just thinking we're moving up to April 1st as this show has been recorded and we're about to cross the $15 an hour threshold, minimum wage, which is a kind of a demand that we fought for a long time. And also there's big changes to the 0 hours regime. Do you want to just tell us what some of these changes will be, Mike, and if you like, what are the more profound effects for workers in general?
Well, the increase in the minimum wage to $15 is a sort of a belated response to a campaign that that we waged a few years back for a $15 minimum wage. Probably it needs to be at a higher level, but it's symbolic, I think, that we've passed that number. So it'll go up to $15.25 on Friday with a 50 cent an hour wage increase. So there'll be some, I don't know, tens of thousands of workers who will be on the minimum wage who will get a pay rise as a consequence, and tens of thousands of people above them, like in the fast food industry, who may be on higher rates, but will be our collective agreements are tied to the change in the minimum wage.
So that's the good thing about having a union contract, because sometimes you tie that increase in. But a lot of workers who don't have a union contract, it's not automatic that you get that kind of increase in percentage terms or even in 50 cents terms passed on.
No. So all the union contracts that we have at McDonald's and Burger King and so on will go up at least 50 cents or the equivalent percentage increase, which I think is about 3.4%. But if you're not covered by a collective agreement, then it's entirely up to the employer, anyone who's above the minimum wage, whether their wage goes up as a consequence of the minimum wage going up.
So let's say I'm a worker out there, I'm on, what, $15.10, so my boss was going around, I'm not a minimum wage employer, I pay more than the minimum wage, which was $14.75. Now the minimum's gone up to $15.25, you said, so let's get that number burned into our heads.
So legally the employer is obliged to increase it from $15.10 to $15.25, but not obliged to increase it more than that unless that's specified in their agreement. Now a lot of employers will just leave it at that. They'll think that a 50 cents rise is more than you deserve anyway, and so the only way you can get around that is by talk to your workmates. Organise them collectively, contact the union, get them to join, and you can negotiate a collective agreement. Everyone out there who's on an individual employment agreement, if they get their workmates together, they can negotiate an immediate pay rise. They don't have to wait for a year. They can, as soon as they get two or more people, they can negotiate a collective agreement, assuming you've got your union's backing. So it's something to consider. Anyone who thinks that they've been not getting a fair deal, or they not getting their breaks, or they're not getting some other legal entitlement, then the only way to really overcome it is to do it collectively. But unions usually need a significant percentage of your work group to join to make that to make that a meaningful thing.
Yeah. Now, so as well as the wages gone up, there's big changes with 0 hours, right? Now, we fought this in the fast food companies, Sky City, etc. Some places, Unite organizers, we are about to negotiate around this, for example, in the cinemas. But there's some interesting kind of grey areas there that probably the union will have to pursue. For example, in the legislation, there's a wording there that adequate compensation must be provided for a worker if they're available but they're not used. What does that mean, and what do you think is adequate?
Reasonable, I think the word is, but and what's reasonable? Not so what happens with the new law is that it says to employers, you should guarantee a certain number of hours in the agreement, and there is certainly a clear implication in the law that they should maximise that, in the sense of that the law says you've got to have good reason to have what they define as an availability clause. So say I'm an employer, I want to give you a guarantee. I can guarantee you 20 hours a week. Mm-hmm. I may be able to use you for another 10 hours a week, so I've got an availability clause for 10 hours a week. In order to have the availability clause, I've got to have a good reason. So, running a cafe, and there might be unexpected demand, so I've got to be able to make up some sort of reason. I can guarantee the 20, but the 10, not sure of. So you've got to have a good reason for that. And then you've also got to pay reasonable compensation for the worker agreeing to be available for those additional 10 hours. We've got a similar situation now in the fast food industry, because we negotiated contracts with our employers that they would guarantee 80% of the hours worked over the previous 3 months. So they put that as a sort of a guarantee. And then there's availability. The worker has availability for additional hours, but that's very variable in the fast food. So it depends a little bit on the worker's individual choice, what their availability is. Mm-hmm. Often they put quite extensive availability because they want to maximise the hours that they work. But the employer is going to be more difficult to run that system. So I think it's going to shrink, because the employer's got to pay for all the hours that the worker is available in addition to the ones that they guarantee. And they've got to come up with a number for reasonable compensation. Now, this courts may well determine this in the future, and it may vary industry by industry. I would think that, for example, there would be high compensation, high relative, not sure what to, but anyway, at the higher level for those people, for example, like a pilot who must be on call, can't leave town, sitting at home waiting to be called in emergencies, and
can't have a drink,
that sort of thing. So that sort of compensation, and they probably already negotiated compensation for that, so there'll be some sort of standard around that. A fast food worker who may find out the hours that they're working their final roster a week in advance, say, then that may be a lesser compensation. So the worker, because they're going to find out at least a week in advance, but it's still an availability clause, still compensation that should be paid for it.
So what are we talking about here? How are you going to pay me? Are you going to pay me $50 a day standby, or are you going to pay me at rest?
It's actually not stamped. Often the industries that we're dealing with, the availability clause will be known about a week in advance. The call-up one, being on call, that's a different thing, and I think that requires a higher compensation. But just being available to get additional hours put on the roster requires some compensation, requires reasonable compensation. But what that is, not 100% sure. So it could be, for example, that the additional hours are paid at, so you get 20 guaranteed, and any additional hours you work, it could be paid at a higher rate, and we could claim a time and a half rate for those additional hours. Or it could be that there's a daily allowance for each day that you work in addition to the ones that you are sort of rostered for, or or yeah. So there's going to be a lot of sort of toing and froing, and it's going to be interesting. And I'm hoping, to be honest, that the onus will go on the employer to guarantee all the hours. Why have guaranteed hours and guaranteed shifts? We're moving closer to that at Burger King. I hope we can do that at other companies as well.
The interesting thing about this, and if we lick 0 hours, if we defeat this regime, it actually changes a lot more things, or potentially could change a lot more things in the 21st century workplace, right? For example, neoliberalism, the attack in the unions, Toby will bring you in here, maybe you can talk about the kind of British context. But, you know, back in the day, in the 70s and the 80s, workers in New Zealand had guaranteed hours at reasonable pay. And if you worked longer than these hours, or if you worked hours that were on social hours, nighttime, weekends, for example, we've just come through Easter, massive pressure on workers to work on Easter Sunday. You know, that was paid for adequately. Do you think all hours are equal? And if they're not equal, you know, should there be reasonable compensation paid for those hours? So, Toby, for example, I mean, in Britain at the minute, people still have weekend rates.
That's my understanding. I haven't lived there for a few years, but there's always uplifts on weekends. I work in an industry here which is quite... It doesn't have any acknowledgement of public holidays. It doesn't have, which is the film and television industry. That's another one which will have to form some form of regulation. But I'd say that the atrophying of workers' conditions and rights in England would probably be fairly parallel to the circumstance here, judging by all accounts. I wouldn't hold any hope for that being a particular bastion of...
We got the phrase zero-hour contracts from the UK newspaper.
I'd say so.
Labelled it here, but... interestingly, though, Joe, in the United States, which is not the advance guard and comes to any workers' rights anywhere, they have...
I thought they surrendered to Cuba over the weekend, Mike.
They have time and a half for wage workers law, you know, time and a half for
overtime
for work in excess of 8 hours a day or 40 hours a week. So time and a half rates. And they've just extended that to tens of millions more, Obama did, to tens of millions of more salaried workers who because there'd been no adjustment to the level for several decades, that he restored it to its previous position and brought in some tens of millions more. So that's considered a right. I think we should have that right in New Zealand. We've got it in only one of the fast food agreements. I think we've got it at restaurant brands where you get overtime rates over time and a half. But I think it's one of the legal rights that should be restored, because that ensures that when you are working excessive hours, there's extra compensation for it. But it also, it's an onus on the employer to think about what they're doing and whether they should be hiring more staff and sharing the hours around if there's a penalty, because it's called penal rates, because it's a penalty on the employer for working people excessively. And a lot of workers might like it, but they've turned, for example, they've turned the security and the norm in the security industry to be a minimum 60-hour week. And these are minimum wage jobs. People don't they argue for more hours rather than less. And I think they need a pay rise. But I think it'd be a good thing if we had time and a half kicking in as well.
I think then on that, just to refer back to the industry I work in, which is not exactly an industry which carries much sympathy, but film and TV workers, the standard day is 10 hours 45. You reach time and a half at 10 hours 45, and you reach double time at 12 hours. So you're mandating people, again, 60-hour weeks. These are individually negotiated contracts. There is no unionisation. A lot of people would suggest that we wouldn't have a film industry if it was unionised, and there was obviously a few bits in the press a few years ago about it. Well, the jury's out as far as I'm concerned on that one. But yeah, it's extremely onerous. There is no opportunity to refuse work. Refusal of work pretty much is tantamount to resignation in my game. But as I say, this is not exactly a minimum wage industry. The pay rates are relatively elevated, but certainly you know, this is a major issue for us, but the guarantee of at least time and a half and double time does incentivize a great deal more sacrifice from the worker. And it also does push back against the employer to a great extent, because you'll often find they're really keen to get themselves together and organise when it's pushing overtime, and suddenly things start falling into place miraculously, and we get everything we need, so they can avoid paying us our overtime.
Yeah,
a lot of shenanigans happen, but certainly, yeah, it does ensure a minimum standard of pay for performance, really.
I noticed that when we did get that time and a half in restaurant brands, and, you know, previously what had happened was the favourites, or those who kissed up, got 50, 60 hours, and we had people scrambling, you know, for 15, 20, you know, who needed those hours and weren't getting them. And once the overtime brought in, that was it. That was the great leveller, it was great equaliser. And we kept the line because some people were like, trying to get rid of it, but in the end they did pay overtime when they couldn't get people, when they needed people, and, you know, they couldn't juggle all the favorites and stuff. Pay them the overtime. That's the cost of doing business, and $100 million profit, whatever profit they're making, you know. Do you think this will be part of a kind of development, Mike, after the 0 hours kind of thing is licked, that we start looking at the whole concept, is every hour equal?
I think that's an important issue, and I think that we can and should sort of be advancing those sort of demands. So you can look at work that's unsociable, and even weekend work. Now they do that in Australia. No reason why they can't do that here. The casinos in Australia pay penal rates on the weekend, and for overtime and
did they go out of business?
No. What I think that's important is that we don't accept the pushback that happened as being written in stone. That is, workers over many countries, much of the advanced capitalist countries in the world, during those last three decades, were pushed back in terms of their rights and their conditions, and we lost. That's an element of history, but it need not be written in stone. There were big battles fought. They broke many unions, but they also broke confidence and courage that working people had for almost a generation. But generations change, and we can regain our confidence and our ability to struggle. And I think we proved that in the fight against zero-hour contracts, that, in fact, employers had overreached in terms of what they had taken from us by putting hundreds of thousands of workers on zero-hour contracts in New Zealand and it becoming a norm for
millions in Old Blighty. Yeah,
yes,
Toby.
Yes, millions,
they overreached in terms of what the public broadly, public would accept and consider reasonable, and there's no reason. And part of you can establish a new reasonable through struggle. You don't have to accept. The same way there's been such a big reaction to some of the progressive ideas being advanced by Jeremy Corbyn as the new leader of the Labour Party in the UK, and by Bernie Sanders and on the left of the Democratic Party in the United States.
So is this part of your plan for an international crusade, Michael, then, that you're going to the great metropolitan centres of London and Detroit to spread the flames of the workers' jihad?
To be honest, Joe and I had planned a wee holiday back, and Joe's to go and visit his family, and I thought I'd tag along and see the 1916 anniversary of the Irish Revolution. I thought this would be a nice little holiday, and Joe can be my tour guide. That'd be very nice. And we'd see some of those old drinking horts, and it'll all be fun and games. But because we passed the law in New Zealand just last week, outlawing zero-hour contracts, this became a little bit of an international sensation, because it's a big issue in the UK and Ireland. And so so what was going to be a holiday has turned into a bit of a working holiday. And we've been invited to speak at May Day in Dublin at a big meeting with Jeremy Corbyn, the British Labour leader in London, and the US unions are also keen for us to go back and join them when they evidently going to have about 10,000 workers besieging the McDonald's AGM or McDonald's Corporation AGM in Chicago in sometime.
And rock and roll, Toby, so we'll be
going to that as well with a couple of McDonald's delegates.
You're a big Corby supporter, eh?
Yeah, I've got qualifications. I marched with Jeremy Corbyn years ago. He's an admirable man. He's never resiled from any issues of social justice, political justice, economic justice. There's a lot of talk of a change for British Labour Party leaders. Highly unusual character to actually have transcended the normal party system, but referring back to the intergenerational thing, we seem to have lost a generation to the capitalist sort of exploitation model of the workplace. And we're very encouraging to see that without any particular education or mobilization or indoctrination, a new generation has just emerged out of the English population who are quite happy to look at what are clearly issues of injustice, disenfranchisement and disengagement, and engage themselves in a massive grassroots process. Similarly echoed here when you looked at the images of the zero-hour workers, pickets and demonstrations and blockades, which these were young people who didn't need to be radicalized by what their parents told them. They were radicalized by the circumstances they found themselves in. And this is an important thing for us to take forward. It's, this is very encouraging. Corbyn has been attacked by the established Labour parliamentary party, which of course have to some degree an interest in maintaining status quo, and the terrible fear is that he will somehow squander our chances, although he's swelling the ranks. So it's a very complex situation. It's highly politicised and it's highly entrenched. He's certainly a different character from Sanders in many ways.
Why do you say that?
Well, I just think that he represents quite a distinct challenge to Sanders. Bernie Sanders has throughout his campaign has made noises off to the side, which suggests that he will be not. He doesn't intend to fundamentally challenge certain industrial relationships in America, not just workplace industrial relationships, but in relationships between politics, power, funding, and the massive industries which underpin U.S. Democracy. And these are not necessarily democratic industries when you realize the funding for military organizations like the CCA, which is an enormous privatized prison company. We're not talking workers' unions, we're not talking nurses and other such industries and sort of social industries. We're talking relatively anti-social industries, which are co-opting power. The situation is very different in England, so it'll be interesting to see how this one plays out. Obviously, it's a bit of a shame that Bernie is not doing so well in terms of delegates. Statistically, he really is a long shot still at this stage. We don't give up hope that he can, at the very least, influence the likely nominee Hillary to swing her policies to a popular leftist position. He's established that his position and his policies are extraordinarily popular. Mm. Whether he gets a nomination or not, he will be a major force in this next election.
Mike, historically you've been quite critical of the Democratic Party, but are you enthused by Bernie Sanders in America?
I'm enthused by the fact that what he is articulating, what people are responding to, is a very sort of progressive program for the United States. Now, this being right-wing is institutionalized for both the Republican and Democratic parties. So the Clinton administration, in my view, could be considered nothing other than quite the previous President Clinton, not the...
Bill.
Bill. The previous president, they ended welfare as we know it, which meant millions of people were put off welfare. They started
mass incarceration.
They started wars all over the world, and they started they continued the so-called war on drugs and imprisoned millions of of their own citizens and caused millions of people to die throughout Central and South America and Afghanistan and so on, all part of this. So the Democratic Party were the party of Wall Street. So all of their main people were Wall Street appointees, and they were also deregulated the banking industry and helped contribute to the new crisis that we're gripping us now. So very unusual that from that party that a popular left-wing view is being articulated. I think that to progress fully, that we need to break with the Democratic Party ultimately in the United States, and they desperately need a third political force because they will.
So if Hillary stitches it up with her super delegates and shafts old Bernie, you think
there's still a chance? No, you see, there's still a chance Bernie can win, right? So up to a few days ago, there were three states and just a few days ago, but just before those, he needed 60% of the delegate votes in the period going ahead. He got 80% in the first three.
Wow.
Yeah, he got 80% in the first three states.
Like Alaska and Hawaii and.
But one of them was reasonably, 100 odd, so, and then now there's two huge ones, really, and it's California and New York State. So.
Who wins those?
Yeah.
It's rock and roll. Listen, let's take a song there, because this fits in quite nicely. And this is a song by the Manic Street Preachers, good bunch of Welsh mining supporting socialists. And it's called "If White America Told the Truth, It Would Collapse in a Day."
Next Thursday, you're invited to watch Rising Tide's live coverage of a gala tribute and salute to Ronald Reagan. Host Haley Barbour joins special guest Lady Margaret Thatcher in celebrating the former president's 83rd birthday. Tickets are $1,000 a plate, but you can see the event free on GOP TV.
There ain't enough white in the stars and stripes. Well, my feelings were clear about this. Bow down, ye colonials, to your butcher's apron. Toby, no, you bastard.
No ambiguities from you, Joe, as ever, and to be expected and admired. Yeah, we did have a full and frank discussion about the flag debate, which, of course, has raged until death, and and I mean, it will go on. I mean, the legacy of this unfortunate incident will, I think, will plague us for a little bit longer. It's certainly something which other people are trying to sweep under the carpet. But obviously, me and Joe came to a discussion on this on probably some moot points, some to be disputed. I think it's pretty clear Joe's feeling about the butcher's apron, which is the Union Jack, as it is known to others. I share a lot of those sympathies, having been brought up in England and spent a lot of time protesting against our imperialist aims and our colonialist wars, and put myself in front of airstrips and US bombers and did all of those things to try and to foil a bit of the blood that splatters the Union Jack. This wasn't successful. I lived in England, we were at war with somebody. And if we weren't at war, we were supplying special forces troops to carry out executions and incursions and any number of different military actions. So
New Zealand do the same under that flag?
Well, we do. I think we do, and I think it's underrated. We've always made our military presence a sort of an advisory capacity. But when you're advising a US bomber of which house to blow up, you are clearly in an act of war. You are not somebody who is advising. You are somebody who is directing. I respect our troops. I respect their lives as defenders of our freedoms in certain respects, but we're not in a case of being, we're not under threat, we're not under invasion. And to suggest that interfering in other people's colonial endeavours and imperialist actions is somehow, exempt from blood on your hands is absurd in my view.
Now, Mike, an interesting result in this referendum was that some of the highest vote in favour of the current colonial flag was in Māori electorates, like Te Tai Tokoro was 72% or something. What's your feelings on this?
I don't think there was a left-right thing in most people's votes. People voted on quite individualistic attitude. I was relatively neutral. I share Joe's horror at the Union Jack. I've got no sympathies for the bludgers who constitute the British monarchy, and
not even the hats.
They're just a waste of money, and waste of time. And it's a silly and anachronistic thing that we run a system using those. However, I am also very suspicious of the sort of nationalism that tries to tell us any form of nationalism. So whether it's with our own head of state or we got our own president or we've got our own flag and we should be proud and patriotic and all the rest of it, I'm just very suspicious. Other than some sporting events, and the good thing about sporting events is we don't usually use the national flag. We use
a fern.
We use a fern, and so on. And so we don't. And so I don't feel so bad when I'm sort of cheering on the All Blacks or the.
Hold
Warriors
on here. I hear the chants over here from this short-haired gentleman. England.
Never have worn an England shirt for a specific reason. Very specific reason.
What? Because it's identified as fascist.
Absolutely. I'm sitting here today in an Arsenal shirt, which is my London harpoon.
Oh, the artillery.
The Gunners is their former name. But I'd never wear a Union Jack on my chest because I know how much this represents to others. But on that point you make, Mike, I think one of the scariest aspects, I totally concur, is the nationalism, which has been whipped up in two camps, for and against change. There's been obviously resiling to the RSA and the debt of honour we have to those fallen for our freedoms, etc. And there is also a nationalist sense that we must somehow reject any ties to our our previous sort of ethnicity power block with Brits, Irish, Scottish, you know, that sort of elite group, and we somehow march forward into the future waving a silver fern led by Richie McCaw and John Key into an uncertain future in my book. So there was certainly nationalism being used in both contexts. My feeling about the Te Taikoro result was this may well have represented a very much a protest vote against John Key and not an endorsement of the Union Jack. And I think these things are quite in contradiction from themselves. And that's my feeling. I can't poll that and I can't suggest that there's any. But for them to be supporting, for a large, impoverished, largely impoverished, marginalised Māori electorate to be endorsing what was represented to them as a colonial status quo by many media sources, it's totally counterintuitive. So I get the feeling that
this is the area of New Zealand that gives Honohaka and chopping down the flagpole and stuff in Russell, right?
Some people wanted to vote against it because it was proposed by John Key. And in my book, that's as good enough a reason as any. You know, I mean, if you're going to have a reason, right? So.
That was the only reason I had.
It wasn't a left and right thing. It wasn't even progressive conservative thing or whatever. It was people, and because of that, you can do what you like and you're fine. You know, don't sweat it.
I think though, probably what you were talking about, Toby, and Keith Locke wrote about this in the Daily Blog. It's probably set back the kind of arguments about the Republic for quite a while. I know from talking to Maori comrades that they're confused about what we mean about a republic, right? There's a fear that if it's a republic, a corporate republic, you know, you're swapping American imperialism for British imperialism. That's what a lot of people feel around the TPP, for example, a lot of confusion around that. That the special relationship that was there in the Treaty of Waitangi between Māori and the Crown will actually be nullified or glossed over or lost.
It's not an entirely unreasonable fear. I mean, it's constitutionally, I'm not quite sure what a constitutional lawyer would say about that or a treaty lawyer, but it's quite terrifying in that respect. You can't really resolve historical issues by moving forward blindly with changes which are essentially structural and all-encompassing without consideration to those issues. And there's been very little consideration of that aspect, formally, in the press, in Parliament or otherwise. These are concerns raised by people but not discussed by people in power, and that's a very valid point. One of my great fears about the Lockwood flag and John Key's initiative to sort of rebrand us without any form of analysis of what that would mean legally, structurally, or otherwise, I see it as a form of neocolonialism. We are transcending an existing colonial symbol with a symbol imposed, I'd suggest, created, imposed, and rigged by a panel selected by cabinet, and you know. I won't get into the details of how obviously it was corrupted the process was, because I think the majority of people in New Zealand had that feeling. Mm-hmm. But to leap to a stage where elite, which remains unchallenged, is rebranding and washing, basically sweeping the other one under the carpet and putting a new one in there, which has no historical context. This ensures an ongoing colonial ascendancy, in my view, and enshrines an elite which has no justification for being there in a multicultural society.
I think we've got to look at for a future constitutional arrangement, it's got to be and I think we need one in New Zealand for a number of reasons. Partly because the British monarchy is an anachronistic sort of connection and a fundamentally undemocratic thing, that a representative of a monarch is the head of state who can technically dismiss governments, as they did in Australia. Even a majority elected supported government was dismissed by a reactionary old goat who was the governor general, and And so this is a deeply undemocratic thing. So we need to, in the new arrangement, we need a deeper democracy through the constitutional framework, and a deeper democracy must involve a partnership with the Indigenous people who've got to buy into whatever process is set up.
And
if it's not bought into, it's not a proper process, because we live here ultimately as guests of the Tangata Whenua.
Which leads me nicely to the next song, which is Where's Our James Connolly by Liam Weldon, because about 100 years ago today, if you're listening to this show, we give them their marching orders in Dublin. We didn't do it through a referendum. James Connolly was the great trade union leader of Dublin, and he led the rebellion in Easter 1916. Where's Our James Connolly?
They carried him. bright May morning. Late in May, a quick light.
There's another war raging on this planet, the war on drugs. It affects millions of people. Mike was talking about it earlier on, narco states in Latin America, governments being overthrown, left-wing governments being overthrown. Mexico, you know, a failed state. And, I mean, look, things are also changing, though, right? In the United States, in Colorado, for example, it's now legalized. You know, it's legal to have medical cannabis, right? Trade union leader Helen Kelly, very sick at the minute, and has been campaigning to legalize medicinal cannabis, right? And we've got tens of thousands of working class people in New Zealand criminalized every year over this.
I'd say of every class in New Zealand, yeah. not class specific cannabis use, and the criminalisation would only be the working classes generally. Oh, okay. To be fair,
one law for the rich, one law for the poor, is it?
Well, anecdotally, that's very much the case. I think worldwide, there's a massive debate right now about ending the war on drugs. There was a very telling piece of information which was released recently. It was one of Nixon's key advisors who was the architect of Nixon. Essentially, was the architect to the war on drugs. It was a flag raised and then flown for many generations and flies today over US policy, and indeed still UN policy. 2009 was the last time the UN reviewed its policy on the war of drugs and decided to continue the war. We would propose that we need a peace negotiation and we need to start some healing, generally speaking. You know, you're looking at situations where if we don't take immediate and drastic action, we are, heading into a relatively ridiculous and untenable situation. We're organising a march through Normal, a number of other organisations. I believe we have the backing of Unite and other unions. The Nurses Union haven't yet to come to town, but a number of organisations will be backing this, and this is scheduled for the 23rd of April, a National Day of Action, because we've reached the point where the debate has been elevated to such a point we need concrete and direct answers from all our main political parties as to what their policy will be going into the next election. We've sought this for years as cannabis activist groups, but they have to answer this question now. It's beyond ridiculous that we aren't addressing this in New Zealand.
Mike, do you think the time has come for a ceasefire in this war?
Oh, absolutely. It's been a failure on every level. In the United States, it's criminalized. It has been a class war as well, mm-hmm. I think, and a race war. And it's been fought often in other countries. So in the United States, in advanced capitalist countries like our own, the wealthy and the privileged are really prosecuted for their cocaine possession,
harder drugs,
or whatever recreational drug that they have, and it's working class kids and often Maori and Pacific kids who are the ones who get rousted and picked up on the street or as routine, as part of routine operations of just sort of. That the cops run. So you end up tens of thousands of people picking up prosecutions. It's a complete waste of time. In a series of states in the United States, not just Colorado, a whole series, there must be at least 6 to 10 states have legalized marijuana use. Across the board, not just medicinal use. I went to Washington State, where there were stores, every sort of 10, 12 kilometers in the state. There you could access a marijuana store with high quality.
This is creating employment, is it?
High quality product and being taxed and being a lucrative and important part of the economy, and no one being harmed by it any more certainly than you get harmed by smoking any other substance or probably much less so. There's no science associated with these prohibition regimes. That was true with the prohibition of alcohol in the 1930s.
Well,
it was
that
madness.
Worked well, yes, didn't that, it, yes, creating yes. the mafia?
Yes, yes, yes. And the prohibition regimes are just the same. They create giant criminal cartels or feed criminal cartels. And so every country that has...
you've talked about that, how, I mean, the West and its imperial adventures is talking about the beheaders in ISIS, but probably the most vicious criminal organization at the minute is the Mexican drugs cartel.
Indeed.
Who behead people routinely, by the hundreds and thousands of in Mexico every single year. And the billions of dollars in Colombia and in other states. Now the only people who have made progress is where there's been an element of legalization. And I get angry when people go, "Oh, you're just going to encourage drugs." This is stupid. There is no limitation on drug use. You can buy whatever you like, whenever you like. All that happens with anything is you change the price of the product by how effective a particular regime is. The only way you can do it, and that's where they've been successful in reducing drug use, and reducing the ties between drug use and major criminal organisations is where there's been an element of legalisation.
This is a key thing, and it ties into, unfortunately, the great debate about free marketeering and whether utterly unregulated markets are a benefit or a negative impact on society. We've recently seen Obama in Cuba. Obviously the doors to Cuba are miraculously opening at the hand of the majestic President of the United States. Now, that's all well and good. We have to look at Cuba. Cuba has the lowest murder rate of any country in Central or South America. It has the safest capital in Central and South America. It has the lowest drug addiction and use in Central and South America. The highest ratio of teachers and doctors per head of population. Now, this is a country which is very firmly aware of the citizens' needs and the social imperatives ahead of market imperatives. One of the things which is terrifying honest, hard-working Cubans is the Americans are essentially opening up casinos, brothels, prostitution, etc., and drugs to accessorize tourism. You can't have American tourists without A, widely available cocaine, B, sex workers. Now, this has proved every single place where Americans frequent. They're not specifically an American holiday fantasy. These places are frequented by sex tourists and drug tourists all over the world. Amsterdam would be a good example of such a location. What is going to be happening? One of the other major cartels which will be moving into Cuba and will be preparing at the moment is the Zetas cartel, the most terrifying, murderous band of thugs outside of the U.S. military on the planet. Now, if we allow this transition, these transitions to happen without actually imposing market controls over this industry by legalization, we're inviting a world of pain and suffering on people who have been spared it so far. Cuba would be one of the few examples on the planet which has been spared the free market in this respect. So I'm all about regulating markets, particularly the drugs market. And I personally come from the point of view that that's all drugs, not just cannabis. But I think we need to tackle the most prevalently used drug in this country, the most medically positive of the prohibited substances. I mean, Peter Dunn, unfortunately, seems to have tied us to Australia. We're going to wait for a bunch of Australian research. Well, there's plenty of research from highly credible international...
it isn't about research, though,
it's not. It's about delaying policy.
What's that little pup, that National Party guy who's in trouble with his staff? Who's a prostitute. No offense to sex workers, but he's a pimp to the tobacco companies. What's his name?
Oh, that guy. Oh, I can't remember his name.
What's the medical, stuff around nicotine?
Well, it sells cancer drugs, doesn't it?
It's cancer. Kills people, right? So it's not that debate. It's a lack of political...
Hopkins University and the Lancet's just produced... Well, the Lancet in Britain, the John Hopkins University produced a staggering call recently after an extensive panel of medical experts has analysed all the various cost-benefit schedules in terms of health and well-being of criminalisation and has come out firmly in favour of legalisation of all drugs. It's quite a detailed report, and these are not quacks. These are not hippies or stoners or otherwise. These are people who have examined the evidence.
And a dozen former presidents of Mexico and Colombia who have carried out this war on the behalf of the United States and know all they've done is murder their own people and have want to change course.
When's that march on, Tully?
So 23rd of April, which is a Saturday. It'll be a march. We're trying to organise it on the basis it'll be a national day of action. We'll be encouraging people in local centres up and down the country, if they feel passionate about this, if they know people who are involved in this war, victims of the prohibition of the medicine, which is one of the key aspects. People are dying in pain as we speak because of denial of one of the few medicines which is it can tackle anti-nausea and pain relief during chemo, etc., etc. It's also one of we'll be marching Queen Street, possibly Altea Square to Albert Park. The route hasn't been determined yet, but we're aiming for a 2 p.m. start on the 23rd in August at Altea Square.
Mike, do you think the union should be there?
I think we should support it. I think these laws are fundamentally anti-working class, and we have a stand in favour of our members' rights.
Can I offer one quote to support that? Nixon's policy advisor, who invented the war on drugs, has recently admitted, and this is an article from the Washington Post, that it was designed to be anti-left and anti-black people. This was the objective of the war on drugs. It was a way of criminalising their opposition. Now it has criminalised vast numbers of our members of our society and population, and these things need to stop. We need to start a peace. That's what I'll have to say about it.
End the war, it's time to legalise it. And here's Peter Tosh. You've been listening to Worker's Voice. I'm Joe Carlin. See you next time. Legalize
it. Don't criticize it. Legalize it, yeah, yeah. And I will advertise it. Some call it of instrument tools.